Impose your will. That's a direct quote from a former presidential advisor, which forms the basis of the current MAGA movement across the nation, which has energized an army of conservatives in this year's election, according to Project 2025. And it's the three words that are explained in detail in the introduction to the new book, Vigilante Nation: How State-Sponsored Terror Threatens Our Democracy. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. You can send your questions or comments to jx@jeffnet.org. Joining me on the exchange is one of the co-authors of Vigilante Nation, UCLA law professor John Michaels. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we dive into the details of your well-researched and deeply disturbing book, let's learn about you first. Give us a sense of your personal journey, your own story arc.
So I've been a professor at UCLA for about 15 years. And for the start of my career, I worked principally on questions of private delegations of public power, involving all sorts of responsibilities from the privatization of welfare services to the outsourcing of sensitive military and intelligence gathering projects. And when I started seeing what was happening at state levels in the United States, state and local levels in the United States, and realized that what governments in particularly red states were doing was outsourcing the kind of imposition of moral and social norms. I started seeing like, hey, there's a pattern here. There's a delegation of force and an effort to expand the scope of conflict from not just from the state to individuals, especially particularly vulnerable individuals, but also from allowing individuals, the public, to enforce their will against other members of the public. And it all started to click to me that this is part of a larger project about power, force, and threats to democracy.
Okay, so let's get to the book, Vigilante Nation. You start with Steve Bannon's clarion call to impose your will. Why should anyone care what Steve Bannon says on a podcast?
Well, so a lot of people don't listen to Steve Bannon's podcast, but the challenge is that some people do, and they listen really carefully, and they act upon what Steve Bannon may be saying because they are swept up in what has been very carefully curated as a movement. And when Steve Bannon was telling people, and among others, Donald Trump, telling people to rally in Washington in January, those who didn't take it seriously realized that they had a major problem, or we have a major problem on our hands on January 6th. So his efforts over weeks and months to support efforts by Donald Trump and others to first delegitimize the likely results of the election and then to simply disregard the results of the election are points of not points of debate, but are strategic plans to change the shape of power in America the way Steve Bannon might have wanted it. In a fashion that we could never kind of turn away from.
So in essence, if we ignore these people, we do so at our own peril.
I think that's the conclusion that folks belatedly came to after January 6th when they realized how much kind of support there is. And then again, starting on January 7th, because there wasn't really a moment of great repentance. Instead, there was a redoubling the efforts to be smarter, more careful, better organized, get laws, get lawmakers to support their cause. And I don't want to say try again next time, but some version of try again next time does seem like something we should take gravely seriously.
Well, that's a good segue into Chapter 1, where you introduced the term vigilante democracy. But it was the title of Chapter 1 that caught me by surprise. And it's titled, quote, "We need something from state legislatures to make this legitimate," end quote. And you put those in quotation marks. So I had a mental pause to wonder what this was that needed to be legitimized. But you put the answer in the subtitle, the January 7 Project. That's a provocative start to the chapter. Please explain.
Yeah, so this is the quote is from Senator Mike Lee, who from Utah, who was on the phone with White House officials, essentially trying to manage the propriety or stabilize the campaign to overturn the election. And basically, he set up some type of guidelines for saying, this is as far as I'll go with you guys, but no further. If you can get state legislatures on board, then I can join you all. But if you don't, we need to do something else. And we use Mike Lee as the kind of avatar for those Republicans who are MAGA affiliated, but not fully entrenched in the MAGA movement. And what would it take to get those folks off the sidelines on January 6th and into the campaign to directly subvert an election? And what they wanted is some kind of legal grounding to do so. And what has happened in the aftermath of January 6th is, and I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but it's a really important element of what's going on today, which is this redoubled effort to do a version or achieve the effects of January 6th in ways that isn't going to lead to a major legal crackdown of the sort that did happen, well, I would say thankfully, right after January 6th, which is the federal government went investigated, prosecuted, arrested, et cetera. How can an election be subverted in the future, or how through legal means? And so what we call vigilante democracy is essentially the justification or the legal justification and the legal normalization of a set of thuggish behaviors that are intended to reduce and marginalize political support for kind of essentially pro-democratic commitments, multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy commitments. And it's all about maintaining essentially what we would call red American power, even though it's a dwindling demographic that actually supports it.
My guest is UCLA law professor John Michaels, co-author of Vigilante Nation, How State-Sponsored Terror Threatens Our Democracy. You can send your questions or comments to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Professor, let's talk about these four pillars of vigilante democracy.
Yeah, so what we say is it's a coordinated and comprehensive campaign. It's not just directed at voting or on election administration, though I'll get to that in a second, in part because the campaign isn't trying to just put all its eggs in one basket. It's also about challenging essentially expressions and manifestations of a politics or a sense of personhood that's antithetical to kind of the red state vision of what they do with power. So we start off with the following campaigns. One we call dissenter vigilantism. The second we call courthouse vigilantism. The third we call street vigilantism. And then the fourth and final one, which is most pertinent to what's going on right now, is electoral vigilantism. But I wanted, before I get to electoral vigilantism, I want to talk about how these campaigns of marginalization and oppression are hitting families and individuals and workplaces in a way that's making it harder for individuals to be fully empowered citizens in the United States. And a lot of it is taking place in schools. Some of it's taking place in hospitals. And again, some of it's taking place in streets and polling places. The essence of it is, though, is if you're a woman seeking an abortion or just seeking control over your bodies. If you're a teacher in a school district that's trying to support the most vulnerable kids in your community, kids who have physical ailments, kids who are transgender, kids who want to learn about a broader culture and history than just kind of the classical stories that tend to marginalize Black and Brown achievements, LGBTQ marginalization in society, et cetera, et cetera. There are dedicated campaigns where individuals and in a community are empowered to challenge those schools, to challenge those doctors, to bring them to court, to supersede their authority in terms of what books they can be offering in a curriculum, what books can be shelved in a school library, what types of policies can be put in place to protect kids who have pre-existing medical conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And the goal is essentially, and it's starting to work, is to push families either out of red states or push them out of the mainstream of political conversations in those states, push kids back into the closet, as it were, to not to ensure that would-be white allies of kids who are Black and Brown don't know the full story of the Civil War or the Civil Rights Revolution or what's been happening over the last 10 years in America as there's been this backlash to multiculturalism. And the story we tell is about the legal techniques that are being used to elevate these individual parents and community members to have power over school districts, to have power over doctors performing abortions or even just consulting on reproductive rights, and to empower them over sports coaches, school librarians, to force all of those folks to make a decision. Either they're going to compromise what they do professionally, or they have to leave the community in order to do their work. And what that does is ensures that the kind of red power remains at the, because it's not a numerical majority in most places, and increasingly not even in the South. But it ensures that they still have predominant political power as everyone gets pushed to the side. Then we turn to the more kind of physically violent forms of vigilantism. And that's what we call street vigilantism, the use of legalized mechanisms to essentially attack and threaten or harass individuals who are gathering for purposes. It's largely been focused around the Black Lives Matter movements, but also LGBTQ rallies. And the idea is, how do we essentially weaponize those who are frustrated by calls for particularly frustrated that there's nothing they can do about peaceful gatherings of marchers for racial justice, et cetera, et cetera. And states like Florida and Oklahoma have authorized essentially have licensed drivers who feel threatened by marchers to use their cars as a weapon of defense and to ram into people. We have police departments around the country that look the other way when counter protesters of the sort that is best embodied by someone like Kyle Rittenhouse come and confront protesters and confront them often with very powerful weapons at the ready. And then last and finally, we talk about the election administration, how vulnerable it is, how vulnerable it's been in the last couple of elections, as well as states are essentially empowering individuals to challenge voter registration, to challenge the way ballots are filled out, and to challenge also the way votes are counted. And part of that involves campaigns of harassment or intimidation, where citizens are allowed to play a role in evaluating their fellow citizens' essentially right to vote, and their right for their vote to be counted. And what we explain in that context again is that raising the fear level, raising the confusion level, is going to make some people just stay away from voting. It's going to intimidate some election administrators from calling an election or certifying results that don't look favorable to the candidates whose supporters are out there with guns and banging on windows.
You wrote, in red states across America, citizens are encouraged and empowered to make to make America great again by recreating or reinforcing traditional hierarchies of race, gender, religion, and wealth. Professor, when I think of racial hierarchy, which I define as the valuing and devaluing of humans by the mythological construct of race and white supremacy, I think of the hostility and violence of white male power imposed upon non-white citizens and their white allies throughout American history. When you write about MAGA loyalists reinforcing traditional racial hierarchy, are you saying that MAGA is a 21st century white power movement?
It largely overlaps with it. So whether it is or it sure looks like it is, I think, less important than understanding where it comes from. And it certainly is a political project that comes out of slavery days, and then after slavery days comes out of the efforts of Jim Crow to essentially go back to slavery days. So I would say that the answer is close enough. And I want to just underscore that the tactics used during those periods were so harrowing, in part because the states were relying on private actors to essentially ensure that no one ever felt safe, even if they thought, well, I'm a little bit away from the government. And therefore, as long as I only have to focus on the government, I could have this amount of freedom or this amount of autonomy or this amount of discretion. But what the government did, the federal government and the state government did in, during slavery times, and then the state governments really doubled down on during Jim Crow, was to empower private citizens to essentially, you know, track down people to in slavery times and bring them back from the North, because there was no expectation that Northern, you know, police officers and judges would do that on their own. And then in the Jim Crow era, it was the state governments were constitutionally limited in how oppressive they could be. So they decided to look the other way while their buddies who are, you know, in civilian life, essentially terrorized Southern black men, women, and children for the better part of the next 100 years post-slavery. And the playbooks really line up in terms of the legal techniques that were used, from the Fugitive Slave Act to looking the other way when it comes time to prosecute someone who participated in a violent beating of a black man who was seeking to register to vote. Is all of this is tracking today with how we're seeing, you know, red state prosecutors not enforcing ordinary criminal law when criminality is being inflicted on individuals who are, again, trying to vote, trying to participate in the democratic process. And even in cases where prosecutors, particularly local prosecutors, are saying, no, we're going to enforce the law. Like in Texas, we saw the governor pardon someone convicted of murder in Austin, Texas, and pardon them because this was a violent act towards a protester, because Tucker Carlson, because national Republican leaders, because local Republican leaders were saying to Governor Abbott, you have to pardon this man. This man can't go to jail for defending his rights, et cetera, et cetera. So the echoes are loud and they're clear, that take us from our earliest and most reprehensible days of American politics being organized around white supremacy to being repackaged today as something slightly different, though in other ways more expansive. It's much more targeted on women today. It's much more focused on LGBT individuals and communities as well today. But the format, the framing, and some of the discourse is awfully familiar to us.
Well, when you talk about the earliest days and how ugly this and vile this was in white supremacist power, you tell the story of the roots of legal vigilantism in America through the lens of George and Martha Washington and a young woman by the name of Ona Judge. I never heard this story before.
Yeah, so Ona Judge was one of the Washington slaves who the family took from the plantation to Philadelphia when when George Washington was president. And as the presidency was winding down, the understanding from interviews given by Ona Judge and other kind of sources suggested that she realized that it's a lot easier to escape slavery from Philadelphia than it is from Virginia. She took her chance. She got on a ship headed to New Hampshire, escaped, and then the Washingtons had to figure out what to do. Do we let her go, or are we going to go after her? And so they called in one of their family members to go after her. And this is, I think, a particularly important story, is that the New Hampshire folks were, whether they were full-blown abolitionists or just not really invested in helping Southerners reclaim slaves, she was actually embedded in New Hampshire society enough that when the Washington came up to New Hampshire, the elites tipped her off, and she was able to kind of stay one step ahead of the family for the rest of her life. But the idea that George Washington, with all these resources at his disposal, nonetheless went after Ona Judge, didn't let her go, didn't say, you know what, it's we have enough or whatever, and actually went on a campaign to go get her, suggest how deep-seated the commitments to slavery are, and also how much there's always been a tension between North and South, and the willingness to go around duly elected leaders in places like New Hampshire in order to, however you want to define it, secure property, reinforce and ensure that every slave on that plantation and every other plantation knows the length that slave owners will go, and to make sure that no one escapes, no one has a moment's peace, is terrifying. It makes, you know, even someone, I'm pretty familiar with American history, and it's a hard subject for me to, you know, to grapple with, to understand how a person who has done so much for the American Republic was doing so much behind the scenes or in his private life to ensure that that American Republic would not be open and equitable for all of us.
Well, I got to tell you, there is so many questions I have and so little time. We have about 3 minutes left, but I have to ask this question. Anyone that wants to know the conclusion, you're going to have to get this book, Vigilante Nation, How State-Sponsored Terror Threatens Our Democracy. Professor, you wrote that the January 7 Project never takes a day off, and it never looks the other way. You offer this as a sobering point. Quote, Christian nationalists wield outsized, perhaps controlling influence over American laws and politics, with Christian nationalists firmly ensconced in positions of power, courts, legislatures, town halls, administrative boards, and more. They can do long-term and possibly permanent damage to the infrastructure of government. Professor, are we experiencing today a resurgence of the 20th century America First movement and the Christian Front, both of which attempted to overthrow the federal government?
We might be. I don't think it's the overthrow of the American government. I think part of the project is that it doesn't have to be overthrown. It just has to be taken over. And that's what makes what we frame as January 7th a potentially scarier proposition than January 6th, because it's not going to be achieved all in one moment, but it's also not going to be resisted with all the same force that the January 6th Stop the Steal was resisted. And so the idea about having since the various groups embedded at every level of government, from school boards to county elections to county supervisors' positions to county sheriffs, up and up and up to the Supreme Court of the United States, it's hard to ignore the fact that there are so many people in positions of influence and prominence who are, if not active supporters, are comfortable with this transformation of the American legal landscape over the last 3 or 4 years? Will it result in something like an American First movement? I think the plan is very clear on this, that it's not as if folks like Donald Trump and other Republicans who are ready to step in his place in 2028 if Trump loses in a couple of weeks. It's not just about Donald Trump. It's about a larger movement. And I think there's enough pieces in place already that we are starting to see the type of legal change that we still have time to disrupt. But if not disrupted, it will slowly and surely change how our democracy functions and who's a part of it and who's threatened by it.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Oh, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you, Professor John Michaels.
Thank you so much for having this conversation with me.
My guest was UCLA Law Professor John Michaels, co-author of Vigilante Nation, How State-Sponsored Terror Threatens Our Democracy.